Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer for the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. And really welcome. We are so excited to bring you here today, the inaugural episode of our new podcast series from the Lung Association and HCP Live. What is Lungcast? Well, it's about as straightforward and as far-reaching as the name implies. Every month, we're going to bring to you world-leading expert perspective on a new topic of respiratory disease and care. From asthma to COVID-19 to lung cancer, we want to open up a dialogue of what's happening and what you need to know. We're going to educate you. We're going to field debates. We're going to tell some of the more incredible stories of medicine. We're going to seek solutions for the problems unsolved in the field. Today's guest, our first guest, could not be a more ideal expert for the time. It is late July 2020 at the time of our recording, and the coronavirus pandemic has reached astounding levels in the United States. Let me take you back to April of this year. Daily new cases were peaking near 40,000. City hospitals in the Northeast and the West Coast were overwhelmed by patients and short on PPE. Emergency doctors faced logistical nightmares while specialists moved into their ranks. New reported cases began to skyrocket, as did deaths. The United States became the new epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. But there was hope this was the worst of the storm. Public health authorities and epidemiologists stressed that as long as everyone adhered to lockdowns and practiced social distancing, that this would be the height of the virus. Flatten the curve was as much a scientific agenda as it was a rallying cry for the millions of Americans who were facing an indefinite new reality. April was supposed to be the worst of it, and it was until about a month ago. From June 22nd to July 12th, a span of 23 days, the virus spread rapidly in the three most populated states of the country, California, Florida, Texas. In those 23 days, the daily record for new U.S. cases was broken 6 times. In those 23 days, the country averaged 45,000 new cases daily. In the span of 23 days, the United States surpassed 1 million new coronavirus cases, a mark which previously took 97 days to reach since the first known case. Here we are now on a new peak unprecedented to the world and to the history of pandemics. Yet, it is natural for scientists to look back to other epidemics for lessons that can be applied to the fight against COVID-19. Think about the HIV/AIDS epidemic. What's the first thought that comes to mind? Is it pathophysiology, its subtypes, transmission and prevention, its symptoms? Probably not. Maybe you first thought about the news coverage, a headline, or a photo. Maybe you thought about a public service announcement, public health message, or maybe a celebrity or movie or episode of TV. Maybe it was the politics or the arguments or the stigmas and the stereotypes. Maybe you just thought about the fear you and so many others had for the virus. Maybe it's the same sort of thing that's on your mind right now about COVID-19. Our first guest bridges these two epidemics better than nearly any expert could. Dr. David Ho, current CEO of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center at Columbia University and Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1996, is synonymous with HIV/AIDS discovery and research. The physician, virologist, and researcher observed firsthand as a resident at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center the first reported cases of AIDS in the early 1980s. Over the next decade, he advanced clinical understanding of the HIV virus replication and progression in patients. He made enormous contributions to the development of antiretroviral therapy, which gave previously doomed patients an opportunity at life with a managed disease. He then turned to HIV preventative research. His team's early research of long-acting injectable gabapentin has progressed so greatly that just this last month, the newest data shows it could effectively prevent HIV transmission in at-risk persons over the span of 2 months between administrations. For 40 years, Dr. Ho has had greatest impact on HIV spread and burden on the world, and he is now focused on the coronavirus. Today, we're talking with Dr. Ho about the parallels between the coronavirus and HIV, the aspects of research he's most focused on in this pandemic, about the progression of vaccine candidates, and what realistically expectations should look like. We hope you enjoy. So, Dr. Ho, again, thank you for joining me today, and we're going to try to talk about your perspectives regarding COVID-19 as it's been existing the last several months in the United States, and certainly try to bring in what your perspective has regarding being a researcher very heavily involved in HIV back in the 1980s and being in the midst of the hotspot of COVID earlier this year in New York City. So I appreciate your thoughts on that as we get started.
Well, first of all, Dr. Rizzo, it's a pleasure to join you this morning for this discussion. Obviously, we're in the midst of a pandemic, which is affecting everyone on the planet. My perspective is that, you know, we're in a disastrous situation right now in the U.S. The country is doing very poorly. We have one quarter of the world's caseload and one quarter of the mortality. And yesterday, we hit an all-time high of over 70,000 new cases in the U.S. So that's a disastrous situation, and it should not be for a strong country with the best disease surveillance system in the world. It's, you know, what we're confronted here in the U.S. is what we would have expected in a developing country, not a rich and strong nation. And so we must, you know, readjust very quickly to respond and bring it under control. I think for every week we slip, it would take 4 to 6 weeks to regain the original position. It's like a rolling a rock uphill. If you slip for a few seconds, you're going to take a long time to regain that position. So I think we really need to wake up as a nation, and we need the political will and the political commitment to want to bring this under control. I think all of us recognize the importance and the urgency of reopening society and regain economic health, but there's not going to be economic health without public health. And so I think it's really crunch time for us to get this under control. And there are many aspects of that that we could talk about. Here in New York City, we obviously went through the worst. For a period, we had, at least in the medical center here at Columbia, we had over 600 patients with COVID in the hospital and with over 240 ICU beds occupied by COVID patients. And that devastation we endured. And now New York is actually doing relatively well, similar to some of the Western European countries, whereas the rest of the country is sort of burning up. And the experience here certainly is applicable to many other places in the U.S.
I wanted to touch on something you mentioned about the implies the public health infrastructure we have in this country. I think some people point to the fact that if there had been some coordinated contact tracing and available testing with quick turnaround, that a lot of the containment could have been done much earlier and therefore slow down the need for mitigation. But even going forward, the public health infrastructure, I've heard quotes of needing 100,000 employees to actually do the kind of contact tracing that's needed in order to maintain the ability of the spread of this if and until a vaccine is available to help develop herd immunity. So I think the public infrastructure is a concern to the American Lung Association, not only now, but part of what we want to do for our COVID action initiative is to make sure we're ready the next time an emerging pathogen occurs, because I think we all know that this is not the last time we're going to be facing something like this. I didn't know what you thought about whether the New York public infrastructure, public health infrastructure is any different, or what we see going forward of putting resources into that aspect of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, overall, our infrastructure is not as bad as it seems at the moment. I mean, CDC has been, over the decades, been an outstanding organization in monitoring diseases and alerting the public to address whatever comes about. But in this particular case, there have been slip-ups, faulty tests initially that led to a significant delay of a month or two at a critical juncture. And that allowed the outbreak in the U.S. to really take off without good tests to monitor, to do surveillance. But we're still faced today, unbelievably, with inadequate testing. And that's because of the surge that we have seen. And once again, we're caught a bit unprepared. And I'm not sure I would put the blame on the infrastructure. I think the infrastructure is there, but there's just not the commitment, the willpower, and a large degree of denial to want to fix this. Indeed, many people are asymptomatic from this infection, and many people only suffer mild illness. But still, a substantial fraction of the infected patients suffer mightily from this viral infection. And of course, a significant number of them died. This is what we're confronted with. So I think we need to have that will to want to fix this problem. And we know it could be done. If you look at a number of Asian countries, including China, life is essentially back to normal, except people wear masks. And the economic growth has returned. So it's doable, and we should be able to do it as well. But there doesn't seem to be the commitment. Now, coming to the contact tracing issue, I mean, that's what needs to be done, but you have to bring the outbreak to a low number for that to be feasible. At 70,000 cases per day, it's pointless. And this is why in other places where success has been seen, you bring the caseload down to a more manageable number. For example, in Western Europe, in the hundreds of cases per day, per country, or in some cases in Asia, for example, where the governments have been more compulsive, they bring it down to single digit per day. And then once you get it down to that level, it's much easier to test, trace, and isolate. So we can't manage that when the caseload is so high. So I think we would have to, you know, carry out more draconian measures until we get to that
point. And you mentioned commitment to more organized testing, but I think the other commitment that's become very much talked about these days is the wearing of masks. Certainly there was confusion early on about who was to wear a mask and who not to, but when we started noticing that asymptomatic individuals were spreading the disease is when the mask directive started to come out. And there still is a lot of, I think, both misunderstanding as well as a lot of individual rights and liberty rights being tossed around for reasons to wear or not wear a mask. But I think we're getting a lot of questions as a public health organization and particularly the Lung Association around exempting people for wearing masks. And we recently came out with a statement with other professional organizations saying that most people, even with chronic lung disease, can safely wear masks, and that we should think about society's needs to mitigate the spread and still wear masks. Do you see anything different about the messaging there? Because I think you're right. We're going to be wearing masks for a while, like a lot of other countries have been already.
Yes, I think, you know, most people should be able to tolerate masks. You know, I find it uncomfortable a little bit, but once you get used to it, it's okay. There may be some special cases where the mask might impair one's respiratory function, but I would think that's extremely rare. I think the idea with masks has been evolving in this country, but the most important point is that the mask helps to contain the virus in the infected person. And yet we cannot come out and say, well, you're infected and you're not infected, and therefore you wear masks and you don't need to wear masks. I think then we bring up an element of stigma if we do that. So what's effective is to ask everybody to wear masks, and you assume everybody's infected. And that's a strategy that works. It's sort of like universal precautions that we have been practicing for now decades. And so the principal reason is to contain the virus in the infected person so he or she does not contaminate others or the environment. And that we know works. And then there's the added element that the uninfected person may also receive a degree of protection by wearing that mask. And I think the experience in other parts of the world, particularly in Asia, has already taught us that's very, very effective, along with social distancing and other hygienic measures. So there's nothing fancy here. It's whether we want to do it or not. And there seems to be lots of unnecessary debate over this. when it's so straightforward in this country and in Brazil and such places where the epidemic is raging.
Let's take a minute to talk about the American Lung Association's new initiative. During a time when many organizations have had to cut back on research funding, the American Lung Association has bucked the trend by doubling down on. One exciting way we have done so is through our COVID-19 Action Initiative. This $25 million commitment is fully focused on expanding our respiratory research program, enhancing key public health measures, and establishing an advanced network of public and private entities to ensure future preparedness for respiratory viruses. Ultimately, the Action Initiative aims to increase the development and distribution of new vaccines, detection tests, and treatments for COVID-19. Considering the Lung Association's 115-year-plus history, improving the lives of those affected by lung disease, we are uniquely positioned to have substantial impact on COVID-19 and future viruses with pandemic potential. To learn more about the Lung Association, our COVID-19 Action Initiative, and our repository of up-to-date resources about the virus, please visit lung.org/COVID-19. I wanted to change gears a little bit and draw on your perspective from back in your HIV years when treatments were being searched for in deadly diseases. Certainly, we're seeing a lot of repurposing of drugs to treat COVID-19, to address the inflammatory response, to address the virus. And I just wonder what your thoughts are looking at the landscape of antivirals and immunomodulating drugs that are being used now. Does any of that relate back to when people were searching for a disease to control the HIV virus?
It's actually very, very similar. When HIV came along, it was a mysterious illness, and it remained so for several years. Whereas in this outbreak, the causative agent was identified very quickly, sequenced very quickly, posted online very quickly. So it's less mysterious here. But in terms of search for a solution, yes, we grab whatever is available and test it and see if they could be helpful. I would say there were at least 3 or 4 dozen drugs that were put forward as potential treatment or cures for HIV. None of that panned out. In this instance, we went through the same, and we have so many drugs being tested, drugs that were developed for other purposes. And lo and behold, it's the same experience. Most of the nonspecific agents don't work. And we went through that with hydroxychloroquine and many others. The only one that is modestly effective is remdesivir, which was developed as an antiviral for a different virus and blocks the polymerase of viruses. And it has modest activity, but frankly, it's not a very good drug. Its activity is very low. Its clinical benefit is there, but very, very modest. It's not going to make a huge impact on this pandemic. While it may help a few patients get out of the hospital a little bit sooner, we still are in need of searching for very effective agents. So that experience with HIV is reflected once again with SARS-CoV-2.
In addition to all the different therapies being looked at, a lot of people now are hoping and waiting for the vaccines to come along. And I understand there's probably over 100 vaccines being evaluated throughout the world. We're getting down to about 4 or 5 that are actually in phase trials of clinical trials are getting close to being able to use in humans. But I think my perspective is there may be another 6 months at least, if not longer. I just wonder where you see the vaccine development at this point in time.
Well, we now have Operation Warp Speed. So the name implies that we're going to move very quickly. And indeed, I think things have moved with unprecedented speed and scale. The last time I looked, there were 17 vaccine candidates in the clinic and 131 in development. That number is probably somewhat larger today. And we have vaccines that went into phase 1 a few months ago, and now they're in phase 3. So that's the kind of speed that things are moving with. And that's because of the urgency and because of the relaxation of rules from the regulatory agency. And frankly, we need it. And vaccine strategies of different sorts are being pursued. We have heard about RNA and DNA vaccines almost leading the way, and yet there are no such licensed vaccine products today. And we're moving with such speed with vaccine candidates that will be ultimately applied to millions and millions, of, if not billions of people. So there is some concern about whether these products are safe in the long term. And yet we could only, in given the urgency, only generate short-term safety data. But, you know, we have to weigh that against what the pandemic is doing. And so I understand and I agree with the approaches being taken. But we need to be cautious. We don't know whether the vaccine responses will be durable. We don't know whether the vaccine responses in the elderly or those with severe underlying diseases would be adequate. Of late, you've probably been hearing quite a bit about antibody responses fading after COVID infection. Well, that's probably expected because with a lot of infections, the acute responses will fade, but the memory of our immune system will persist, and that should still be helpful. So we need to bear all these in mind, but in parallel with the active vaccination effort, there's a lot of work on passive vaccines, specifically the generation of monoclonal antibodies that could very potently neutralize the virus, which is the kind of work that I'm involved with. And there, I could also tell you that dozens of groups have come up with very powerful antibodies, and these antibodies could, at nanogram per ml concentrations, neutralize the virus. And some of these have already gone into the clinic, and they're moving from phase one to phase three after a month or two of testing. And so I think we will have something. But as you know, clinical trial takes time. Especially if you want to look at protective efficacy, that's going to take a large study with significant follow-up period in order to have a good readout. And so I think your initial estimate is correct. It will take about 6 months or so to have an initial readout. And then we need to look at the immunized subjects for longer-term safety data before widespread implementation of an effective vaccine.
I think in the past, maybe around swine flu quite a few years ago, they actually had challenge trials where members of the military volunteered to get the virus and have a vaccine tested. Do you see that happening these days with regard to healthy volunteers volunteering to be sick?
I think there's an appropriate debate discussion going on with that. It all depends on how this pandemic is doing a little bit further down the line. Instead of doing 30,000 subject trial for 6 months, 12 months, if the pandemic is really bad, and it's still getting worse globally speaking, if it's really bad, then the ethical considerations might be shifted by what's going on with the pandemic. And so if you could take, let's say, dozens of healthy younger subjects and challenge them, immunize them, challenge them with the vaccine and get a quick readout in a matter of a couple of weeks and decide whether a vaccine works, that may ultimately be helpful. Now, in flu, of course, the mortality rate for a younger person is lower than this virus. And we also, if we use the right challenge strain, we also have a drug or two to deal with it. And that's what's missing here. We don't have very effective drugs in case a volunteer develops severe disease. But I think the discussion is very appropriate.
You mentioned influenza, and certainly as the Lung Association, each year we have very significant public education around flu vaccine. And I think despite all the efforts both of our societies as well as other professional societies, the vaccination rate tends to be in the 40 to 50% range across the country. Certainly, when we have a coronavirus vaccine, it's going to not make a difference unless people believe in the vaccine and take it. And certainly, there's a lot of cultural issues, mistrust of the government. You mentioned the rapid speed with which these vaccines are being developed, to be concerns that it's not safe. So we as an organization are trying to look at how we can approach the rollout of not only influenza this year, because we think the combination of influenza and COVID's going to make for a dire situation in our health care industry. But then when the vaccine for COVID is available, how can we convince people that this is the right thing to do? And I guess there's no good answer to that, but just want to hear your perspective on it as you see it going forward.
I think overall, we're just not very good at doing prevention. You know, I think we all have the attitude, it's not going to affect me, and therefore, so whether it's prevention of flu or in the future COVID infection or something else, you know, obesity and diabetes, and we're just terrible at doing that, and I think it fits in. And then, of course, with respect to vaccine, there's anti-vaccination effort that's going strong, and that complicates it, and there's a lot of misinformation being circulated. I mean, we need to do our very best to counter that effort. It requires a lot of persistence and tenacity. You know, I have gotten the flu a number of times. I know how bad it could be, so I've been very diligent in the last 15, 20 years getting flu shots. I think it's for the entire public to buy into that is going to be a struggle, but one that we must take on.
And you mentioned misinformation, and certainly like your perspective, certainly for the physicians and researchers listening to this, we've seen such rapid collaboration worldwide when this all broke back in January, and it has led to a lot of studies being put on these preprint medical servers, not really getting vetted the way peer-reviewed journals do get reviewed because of the time that's involved. And that's led to, you know, the headlines that purport cures, and ultimately things get debunked. So do you see much changing going forward with regard to these preprint servers being used to collaborate and get information out? Or is that something that we will need to be pulled back on when and if things slow down?
Yeah, on balance, I still favor this rapid posting and then leaving it up to the investigators to exercise proper judgment. And I think by and large, the more sophisticated readers could figure it out. If I look at a paper in my field, I could very quickly judge the quality and the degree with which I could believe the findings. But what happens is the media picks up on it, and there the level of expertise is not quite the same. You know, then it's up to the individual writer to slant it one way or another. And there's, of course, always a tendency to want to feature the particular story, and therefore it's slanted either very negatively or very positively. And it will lead to, you know, useless efforts, as we have witnessed with many sizable trials involving hundreds of millions of dollars for something that never did work. But I think it's part of the price. On the other hand, the good information that's shared, and we have benefited in our research from information that been posted very early. And then that only the individual investigators will be able to tell you. And I could tell you, for us, it's of tremendous benefit.
I think, at least from what I can tell, the reason for a lot of this information being put out is that this virus seems to be acting a bit differently from other viruses we've dealt with. Certainly, it starts out as a respiratory pathogen, but we know now that the blood vessels, the heart, the muscles, the brain, it seems to be doing a lot to the body with regard to the virus, as well as the body's response to the virus, the immune system, doing things differently than many of the other viruses we have dealt with, or else it's doing it at a degree that we recognize it more now than we would have with influenza or some other viruses. Do you see that as a challenge, the fact that this is acting in a different way than other viruses?
Yes, I think we're still trying to understand how the wide spectrum of disease manifestation comes about with SARS-CoV-2 infection. Why is it that so many are symptomless? Why is it that so many more have only a mild illness? And yet, when a patient does become severely ill, it is initially an infection that involved the airways largely, including pneumonia, and then it progresses to a multi-organ failure. I mean, our patients in the ICU, over half of them had renal failure requiring dialysis. And then we have heard so much about the cardiac, hepatic, central nervous system manifestations. And then of late, some of the multi-system inflammatory problems seen in children post-infection. There's just so much we don't know, and why that only a small minority is susceptible to those complications. So we need to know that. We've seen a bit of that from SARS, but SARS was in magnitude dwarfed by the current one. So the clinical manifestations were not so clearly delineated. And yet we previously have known other coronaviruses that essentially limit their courses of infection to a upper respiratory tract infection. So there's just so much we need to understand. And, you know, this virus, the genome is pretty big. We understand the function of a few of them, but most of the other genes carried by this virus, we're still trying to figure out their precise functions.
And that actually feeds into what my next question was going to be. I know there are some trains of thought saying that we need to be doing more surveillance on those viruses that are in the bats, that are in the intermediary mammals, before they get to humans. The more we know about those viruses when they're existing out in the wild, the better we'll be prepared when they do reach the human ability to transmit disease. That seems to be a large undertaking, and I know there's been a couple projects in the years in the past, but do you think just the whole field of zoonosis and making sure that we know more about the viruses that are out there prior to infecting humans, is that a realistic approach that should be thought of?
Oh, it's doable, and it's being done probably on a scale that's inadequate. For example, surveying the bat population for coronaviruses, that's been largely done by a few labs. There are very good labs, a couple in China and one in the U.S. The one in the U.S. was defunded by the government just a couple months ago. Many scientists protest over that defunding. But that what's clearly it needs to be done. If we had been doing that really well, we would have known that there are bad viruses that are very close to the SARS-CoV-2, and they utilize the same receptor, ACE2, as SARS and as SARS-CoV-2, and they clearly can infect human cells. And, you know, if we had been prescient, we would have been preparing for those. But now, you know, this is the third coronavirus to hit humans in the last two decades. That tells us it's going to keep coming. And we need to keep surveying those viruses. And in fact, as part of our research agenda in my laboratory, we are, of course, trying to address SARS-CoV-2, but we're also trying to address all the related coronaviruses found in other species and see if, you know, whether it's a vaccine strategy or drug or antibody strategy, we could hit a broader spectrum of those viruses. So that kind of work we need to do. And the same on the influenza side or the Ebola side. There are other strains out there. In fact, right now, as we're dealing with COVID, there's an influenza strain that's been found in pigs that could be threatening the human population. Well, why not be prepared for that with a vaccine or a drug and be ready? It's going to be expensive, but it's pretty cheap compared to what we're paying now for the pandemic and the economic consequences.
Yeah, I think a lot of it does revolve around spending money on that learning early on, as well as spending money on being prepared with supplies. You know, stockpiling ventilators and PPE seems like a good idea until you spend the money on it and it sits there and not being used. So it's a matter of putting priorities where they need to be, because certainly the next one's coming, and you see other ways that we can potentially be ready for the next one besides what we've already chatted about.
I think it's to do surveillance thoroughly and think about preparedness. And for me, you know, obviously it's more on the scientific side, but on the logistical side, it's equally important. And PPE you talked about, but, you know, if we look at the troubles we're facing today, another one is testing. I mean, that should have been scaled up to an enormous level that the current surge could be accommodated, but we're not. There's just a lot of logistical challenges that we have not addressed very well.
Are there any things about this current pandemic that we haven't touched on that you would like to emphasize or talk more about how your research is?
Well, for me, our biggest effort between March and June was to isolate as many potent antibodies as we can against SARS-CoV-2. So we, over a 10-week period, pulled out over 200 monoclonal antibodies, and we came up with 19 that were extremely potent, and some of them are more potent and more diverse than anything found to date. And we're trying to very rapidly put them into development as therapeutics and as possible vaccine substitutes. And so that effort is moving very quickly. And certainly, I give a lot of credit to my colleagues who, over a 10-week period, worked 24/7, some without ever going home, to do in such a short period what normally would have taken several years. It's really admirable. It's a reflection of what the scientific community has responded to the pandemic. It's all hands on deck. The mobilization of scientific efforts is unprecedented. And I think we're going to see a lot coming out. I think we must do what we can to slow down the spread. But the ultimate solution will be delivered through science. I firmly believe that.
You mentioned the antibodies. Were you finding the role of convalescent plasma being helpful in many of your patients in New York? Were you using that on a regular basis or in certain situations?
There are people trying that, particularly at Mount Sinai in New York. I think the results are still pending largely, but probably not very impressive as the experience in China found. That's largely because we're just taking plasma from anybody who's recovered without a thorough evaluation of the subjects who are donating the plasma. And we now know that there's extreme variability in antibody titers, particularly if one had only mild disease, then the antibody titers are unimpressive and probably not helpful. It turned out that those with severe disease had the highest titers, but you're typically not collecting blood from people who are sick in the ICU. So there's a mismatch, and that's why the plasma therapy is also very impractical. For every plasma unit you receive, you could probably help one or two cases. So it's hard to scale. This is why we went for potent monoclonal antibodies, which you could only give. You could pull out the very best and only give the very best. That's the strategy that we had taken.
Is the timeline on those monoclonal antibodies similar to the vaccine as far as 6 months, a year, or what? Where do you see that?
They go into phase one very quickly. A month or two later, you can move to phase three, and the manufacturing aspect could be done in the course of 2 to 3 months. And the FDA is also making things easier for these efforts to move forward into the clinic.
Just to touch again on antibody testing for the population, the public, how do you see us being able to determine when and if IgG antibodies that are found in recovering patients are going to confer any degree of immunity to them or reinfection prevention, or how long? I mean, what's the timeline in learning that amount of information?
I think a lot will be learned over the next 6 months about whether having a positive antibody test is equivalent to immunity. I think as a virologist, you know, we have learned from other viral infections that largely should be the case, but we have no formal proof for that for SARS-CoV-2. But if we look at other coronaviral infections, I think antibodies suggest that there would be a degree of protection, although that protection does decrease with time. So I would venture to guess that it would be something similar for SARS-CoV-2. But we need to do the testing for that reason, as well as just to get an estimate of what percentage of the population has been infected already. So I'm generally in favor of trying to learn more about where we stand currently. I think the other thing about testing, moving away from antibody, is the PCR test. And obviously, the PCR test is designed to pick up cases. So it's set to be very sensitive. And that's what we need when we're trying to diagnose a case. A good sensitive test is what we need. However, as you crank up the sensitivity, you also have the specificity issue. And what we're finding is that now we for people who have recovered from their illness, there's a lot of persistent PCR positivity that would then preclude a person from returning to work, for example. And if you look very carefully at those, the cycle number for positivity, so-called threshold cycle, is very high, suggesting that it's extremely low. And whether it's a true positive or false positive is not all that clear. But that positivity is surely not associated with infectivity. So it's keeping some people away. So what is needed is another test, maybe PCR, maybe an antigen test. And it's not for the purpose of diagnosing SARS-CoV-2, but for the purpose of returning to work or going back to school to say, this person has no infectious virus or has infectious virus. That's what we care about. Not some low-level PCR positivity. That doesn't mean anything. And yet we're using that to keep a number of people away from the workplace. If you look at the success in some places in Asia, it's 2 weeks beyond symptom resolution or 2 weeks beyond diagnosis, and they go back and they don't have a problem. And so if you use such criteria and come up with a test that is equivalent to one infectious unit, you could actually make a huge impact on addressing reopening of society.
So that two-week time frame from infection with lack of symptoms seems to be holding pretty well as far as not transmitting the disease if you wait that full 2 weeks.
Yes, and yet that person's PCR positivity could persist for 4 weeks.
The other term that we often hear around antibody and even around vaccine is the term herd immunity. And I hear different things about, well, how much of our population needs to be either vaccinated or infected to get the herd immunity to a point where the virus will start to die out. I don't know what's been thought about COVID-19 as far as herd immunity issues and where that stands in research.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, when you speak to a mathematician or an epidemiologist, in order to be protected by the herd, you need the herd to be about 60-70% positive. I hope we're not there yet. And of course, in other, historically speaking, in other infections, that herd immunity is built up over decades, right? Long periods of time. If we want to reach 60-70%, it's going to be a disaster in the meantime. I think the nation that sort of tried that strategy is Sweden, and they're not doing so well, you know, in terms of death rates compared to its neighbors. And of course, they're not doing any better economically. We actually have experimental data to suggest that we, at this moment, we can't adopt that as a strategy. I mean, the best way to build up herd immunity is via effective vaccine.
I think this has been very helpful on multiple topics. I kind of covered what I wanted to. I didn't know if there's still anything else you wanted to mention, or I'll let my colleagues jump in if they think there's something else we need to address. But I found this very, very helpful. Hopefully so will our listeners.
Dr. Ho, this is Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of HCP Live. When we were covering AIDS 2020 a couple weeks ago, the topic of correlations and similarities between COVID-19 and HIV came up. The answer I largely heard from longtime virologists like yourself was that, beat for beat, this is the same process of response as seen during the HIV epidemic. But the largest difference stressed was that because HIV is known to not affect everyone, advocacy and push for advances in care stalled. It's a very well-defined at-risk patient population, while for COVID, the majority concern is for those that it's been shown to more severely affect, those that are more likely to be ventilated or at least hospitalized. That seems to be why we strategize use of drugs like remdesivir, which have been shown to reduce symptom severity and hospital stay duration, like you mentioned. The fact that COVID is so transmissible, though, is the driver of that difference, and it's why our response and research has been strong and swift, because of the same uncertainty that plagues the masking and social distancing debates. So my question is, when you were discovering AIDS and researching early HIV and managing the great uncertainty of it then, how did it influence both research and the public's response?
Well, I would just say that there are obviously lots of similarities and lots of differences between HIV and SARS-CoV-2. First of all, both are major pandemics, and SARS-CoV-2 is still growing, and so we're only at the beginning. One is a acute virus. The other is a chronic viral infection. One integrates into the genome, one does not. So there are clear differences. I think one thing that struck me is the fact that early on in both outbreaks, there was a large element of denial and inattention that led to the continued growth of the epidemic in each case. And we're still facing that today with SARS-CoV-2. Another feature that also hit home for me was that the HIV patients were, early on, were dying alone because of stigma, discrimination, and unjustified fear. They were shunned by friends and family. And of course, early on, we had no therapies, and they were dying in large numbers in the hospital, largely and largely alone. And then, you know, just from my experience of the past few months, the SARS-CoV-2 severe cases were dying alone, not because there was no support, but because of the isolation required. And that's really registered with me thinking back to the early days of HIV. But what is remarkable is the HIV drug, antibody, and vaccine development efforts formed such a strong foundation that we could move so quickly in response to SARS-CoV-2 on the scientific side. And I talked earlier about the massive mobilization is unprecedented, but the speed of discovery for this new virus is also unprecedented. So those are just some thoughts that come to mind when you talk about this comparison.
Well, I think we're done for today, and I really appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sure this will be well received by our audience. Do you have any last questions for us?
Thank you. You know, you obviously have a lot of work to do going forward, and I wish you well, and if there's some role I could play to be helpful, just let me know.
We'll keep that in mind. Thank you. I wish to extend the sincerest of thank yous to Dr. David Ho for joining us today. And thank you, our listeners, for tuning in to our very first episode of Lungcast. The topic we just tackled is proof of the motto, go big or go home, by diving deep into a complex problem in need of an even more complex solution. What can we learn from past pandemics and epidemics like HIV and AIDS? How can the lessons of HIV decades ago be paid forward to solving the current global crisis? Conversations and collaborations like this are crucial to connecting the dots and keeping the lines of communication open across every medical discipline. To learn more about this topic and others affecting lung health, please visit our website at lung.org. It provides a wealth of information for physicians, patients, and caregivers alike. For more articles, videos, and takeaways from our interview with Dr. Ho, please visit our friends at hcplive.com. Their team will be covering each episode of Lungcast the days after they first air. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, help us spread the word about it to your friends, family, and colleagues through our social media channels on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Next month, I'll virtually sit down with Dr. Ankit Barit of Northwestern Medicine in Chicago to talk about his very recent headline-grabbing and life-saving experience of performing a double lung transplant on a young COVID-19 patient. And we'll soon hear the impact and implications on the future of lung disease are tremendous. Until we meet again, this is Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you to just take it, one breath at a time.